are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on today's show is Professor Jonathan Wilson, an academic specializing in the ABCDs of business and culture. Professor Wilson is a speaker of repute and has over 200 pieces of published work. He also has a D.Lit in Halal and is editor-in-chief of the Journal of Islamic Marketing. Professor Wilson was born and raised in Manchester, the son of a white Scottish father and black Caribbean mother in a Christian household. He converted to Islam in 2000. He has been named LinkedIn Top Voices multiple times, played rugby at school, and is a retired touring musician who provided music and character voices for the first few award-winning Grand Theft Auto video games. Thank you, Professor Wilson, for being a guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast today. To start with, share something of your background with our listeners.
Good morning. I'm a chemistry graduate. I've got an MBA and I've got two doctorates. One of them is in branding and the other one is in the halal phenomenon. Career-wise, I've been a professional musician. I've played at Glastonbury on the BBC. And I wrote and performed some music for the first few Grand Theft Auto video games for all of you rebels out there. And also, as a schoolboy, I played rugby for England. And I'm born and raised in Manchester, and my folks work for the NHS.
That sounds like so many things that you have done and achieved. How do you define your identity, and what role has it played in your personal and professional life?
So that's a good question, actually. I think I'm old enough now for my identity to be pretty fixed, but I am mindful of how I communicate my identity to others. So depending on my audience, I try to refine it a little bit for the context. So if you were to ask me, am I black or mixed race or Muslim or a surrogate Arab or Asian in an African body? Am I a grunge kid? Am I a hip hop cat? Am I an Afro punk? Am I an Afro samurai? Or am I a professor? I'm all of these.
Awesome. I took this quote from an article that you wrote. Academia looks like a pint of Guinness. And this is clearly about the need for diversity in senior roles in higher education. Could you elaborate on that?
So I picked a pint of Guinness because I thought it would paint a pretty picture in people's minds. If we look at a pint of Guinness, it's dark at the bottom and white up top. And if you want to rise to the top, then you have to turn white. What I was trying to convey in the article in just as few words as possible, which is we're still in a situation where there's a lack of representation, particularly amongst senior management and senior academics.
Do you have any suggestions on how that can change?
Revolution! apart from revolution, because academics are not very good at being revolutionary because we like to read lots of articles and make incremental change and not challenge the status quo so much. Well, we've done the monitoring and we've done the reporting. Some more proactive measures have to be taken beyond just the advertisements that say, we welcome applications from underrepresented communities such as black people, women. It's not really working, because if it was, I wouldn't read the same articles year in, year out. Proactively ensure that there are enough minority professionals that are shortlisted. I'm not saying give them jobs. I'm saying give them a chance. And we should also be mindful of who is involved in the interviewing and selection. So if there are people that can't pronounce people's names, right, and they don't have any kind of understanding or appreciation of those cultures and backgrounds, then that's also a problem too. For example, if your name is Ahmed or Osama or Muhammad or Khadija or Aisha, and you write about the Middle East, or you write about Islam or Islamic finance or something like that, people might just assume that that's all that you know, that you don't know about cucumber sandwiches, eggs and chips, Manchester United, and things like that. And so I find that those also percolate into recruitment and selection. And then even if we go across the board, that, you know, I hear stereotypes that, you know, if, for example, you are from India or China, then you're better at quantitative research and mathematics. But, you know, if you are French, then you might be better at philosophy and culture and luxury branding and things like that. And if you're black, then you're a professor of urban culture, which translates to basically, you know, hip-hop, fried chicken, nail bars, grime, twerking.
In your writings, you reference the lack of non-Western mainstream examples in marketing. How does that limit new thoughts and creativity?
Well, put it this way. If we were discussing thought, creativity, excellence, and business practice in the context of women, there was no representation or there were no contributions from women, people would find it easier to see how wrong that was, how myopic, and how fraught with howling gaps in understanding. However, when we discuss race and culture, it's a little bit more difficult for people to get it. If we think about race issues, it's a lot easier for people to assume that they can speak on behalf of communities. That's the thing, that there's just a lack of richness if we just hold on to this idea of a Western perspective of marketing. And it's easy to do, right? Because the preponderance of literature comes out of North America and Europe. Most of the top business schools are coming from these regions. And most of our brightest diaspora go to these institutions and are taught these theories and models, right? And so even if you come out of these institutions and you want to challenge the status quo, but you face a mountain of opposition because you're suggesting that there could be an alternative. And within my own career, I've had to wait a number of years of climbing up that mountain just to be able to put forward the argument that things might be different, or there are alternative ways of looking at things. And so this is why I'm fascinated by alternative perspectives that challenge the way that we think. It's just the idea that we could enrich our understanding through understanding alternative perspectives.
There's a lot of very interesting stuff in there. What is halal branding? Why do businesses need to understand it?
But following on from what I was saying in answer to your previous question, you know, branding draws from a lot of concepts and practices which are actually rooted in religion and in particular Christianity. So my contributions within the book that I wrote called Halal Branding and some of the papers that I've published is to ask the question, what changes if you draw from another faith? You'll be amazed at how brands want to be worshipped. They want you to hold them in higher esteem than anyone else, to devote your life to them, to lose your mind, and to be converted. I've read articles where they talk about the holy grail in branding. We've been in meetings where people have said, let's all sing from the same hymn sheet. What if you don't sing hymns? Some of you might be saying, Avatar is from Hinduism. You're right. But then let's look at what that's done to our understanding by using the term avatar. When somebody has an avatar on social media, we kind of know that that's not the full you. So that's the contribution of Hinduism in terms of social media branding, that avatars are things that we can choose and we can have lots of them in the same way as there are many avatars for Vishnu, right? I'm outlining how branding works for products that are catering for a Muslim audience or audiences across the world, whether that's majority or minority communities, but also how Muslims can brand their products and services to anyone authentically and with integrity, in the same way as brands like Starbucks or Costa have been able to go out there and say, we're from this culture and this drove us to create a brand like this and this is our story. I think the Muslims need a little bit of help in telling their story, especially now in the climate that we're in where people are kind of suspicious. I just wanted to write a feel-good book because if you haven't seen the cover, it's shocking pink and electric blue. I wanted to shatter some stereotypes that we're all about Moroccan tiles and mosque domes and the color green and gold, that we have rich and diverse personalities. And I think it's been well received inside and outside the Muslim community.
I think it's also a huge opportunity to recognize that there is this huge consumer base that needs to be addressed, and brands can do a lot. Moving on from there, the hip-hop counterculture has inspired social change and has been responsible for making ethno-racial issues mainstream. As someone who has spent a lot of time studying it, what would you attribute success to?
Well, I think there's a lot to do with reporting what's happening on the street in a form of zeitgeist. I think painting vivid pictures in people's minds, finding a way to make words attractive and flow, moving your mind, body, and soul, sometimes being quite base, actually, and doing the opposite, making the best use of what you've got on a budget because you couldn't get let into clubs or you didn't have access to musical instruments, you couldn't afford expensive clothes, so you wore t-shirt and trainers. I think rebellion, healthy competition and collaboration, because what you see in hip-hop is there are a lot more artists who would guest on each other's albums than, say, in other genres of music. But also I'd like to focus on the notion of cool, because actually, if you look at its linguistic origins, and I've read research on this, it originates from African slavery. And it's this idea of grace under pressure and creating a mask to hide the oppressor from sensing defeat in you. And now that I've explained that, then you might get a sense of where hip-hop is coming from. People might just think it's showing off, or it's childishness, or they don't understand the wearing of gold chains and or bling or any of those things. But you've got to look to the root of where this is coming from. This is coming from people being excluded and wanting to show that they will not be defeated nor excluded. Because if you look at some of the hip-hop billionaires, whether that's Jay-Z, Kanye, Dr. Dre, Beats by Dre headphones, Yeezy trainers, that's hip-hop's contribution in saying, well, we actually came up with an alternative creative art form, lifestyle, and business model, which is mainstream.
What is your view on cultural appropriation? Who owns words and has the right to use them?
So it's tricky and very nuanced. And we can all be guilty of it, right? You don't know that you're guilty of it until you step outside of your bubble, go to another country, talk to other people, and then you realize that you have. So ultimately, to avoid it, you have to pay your dues and ensure that people who have inspired you are respected, credited, and the people that you draw from and target are acknowledged and respected and elevated. If you can get that ratification, then you're going to avoid appropriation. But sadly, many people aren't able to do that. There've been a number of articles quite rightly pointing out that Black youth culture in America is being plundered for these nuggets of cool that then get turned into advertising campaigns. It was this year that John Boyega spoke about the fact that he was creative director for an advert for Joe Malone. But when they used it in China, they kept his idea, but all of the actors and actresses were replaced by an all-Chinese cast. Now, some people might say, okay, what's wrong with that? That's localized marketing, they're catering for a Chinese audience. But he wasn't credited, and John Boyega is a global superstar. If you're still thinking, yeah, but maybe, you know, he's being a bit paranoid. So why was his presence reduced in Star Wars posters marketed in China? The Black guy, right? You know, he will provide a ton of evidence as to why he thinks that way. And I think it's very compelling evidence. So appropriation is easy. I think that some of the debates on appropriation appreciation are rooted in how much power you have. And so appropriation doesn't appear to be much of a problem if you are from a disenfranchised or minority community who is powerless. But if you have power and you can wield that power and influence, and you are disproportionately benefiting from basically the blood, sweat, and tears and the backs of other communities, that's when people smell appropriation.
That's true. Power and influence are key to this. And also acknowledgement doesn't hurt anyone. You've spoken about white fragility or about porcelain in your latest work. What does that mean?
So porcelain white fragility, another picture that I wanted to paint. It was to highlight just this obsession with perfection, the aesthetic of lightness, how fragile and breakable emotions were in a certain context, and how therefore people felt that they need to be protected. And ultimately, it's this phenomenon of people being offended by those who've been oppressed, wronged, or discriminated. It's a reaction. This reaction tends to be against people with the darkest skin or darker skin. That's for sociocultural reasons, right? But also, I want to make the point that, you know, colorism isn't unique to white people. So we could be discussing Asian matrimonial websites and how they classify people according to how dark they are, whether you are wheatish, olive-skinned, Mediterranean, and how that also affects your marketability with regards finding a future spouse, right? I'm really wanting to just talk about that because I think that it's toxic. And that's one of the challenges that we face. And that also extends to, like, you know, when you've got movements like Black Lives Matter and then people reply with, don't all lives matter? This fragility means that the door gets closed or the real casualty is not being acknowledged. So it's also this response where if a person of color expresses their unhappiness, the door gets shut straight away. Say, I don't see what that has to do with me, or I had nothing to do with slavery, or, you know, I feel hurt by this. And, you know, one of my friends is black and he says that he's never experienced racism. It's describing that, you know, horrible closing of the door.
I agree with you on all levels and specifically on what you said about racism and white fragility. I know that the country where I come from, that is India, is deeply racist. And racism has a different form there. You know, there is colorism and there is casteism. And it needs to change. And there's a lot of education and awareness and perspective that needs to be built. What is woke branding? And how can brands cut through the clutter?
Woke branding. If there's such a thing as woke branding, I'd say that it's socially conscious branding that celebrates the lived experiences of communities that have previously been overlooked or discriminated against. And we're really focusing on racialized communities, right? I think the word woke is an interesting one because you could do a chronology search on that too. And its origins come from, you know, African-American civil rights movement and people talking woke in the past tense, already being enlightened, aware of the reality of your surroundings, ready for the struggle.
What is acceptable stereotyping? Is it ever acceptable to stereotype anyone? And what does this mean?
Well, let's be honest. Marketers, advertisers, PR professionals, day in, day out, stereotype. So I don't think it's wrong. You think, no, you might be thinking, huh? Look, I would say that, you know, that we don't call it stereotyping. We call it audience segmentation, right? But audio segmentation is pretty much acceptable stereotyping, right? And I think it's a necessary function of doing business and targeting audiences because we have limited resources. At some stage, you know, I remember there was one, I had interest from one client and I said, like, they were coming up with a new platform online. And I said, who's your target audience? And they said, mankind. And I said, how much budget have you got to target mankind? Because it's going to be expensive. Their thinking was, no, we don't want to discriminate. We don't want to exclude people. It was like, I get it. I totally get it. So we have to drop a list of criteria, geographic, demographic, psychographic, behavioral, that create these homogenous groups that we can then chase. And that's based upon some inductive and deductive thinking. But effectively, that's stereotyping.
True.
Because if we said it like that, then no one would want to do it. But as I said, what stereotyping? No, we call it segmentation. But we're pretty much doing that. Like, even if we're trying to do the good fight and we talk about the experiences of BMEs or BAMEs or whoever, this is stereotype. But we have to be careful of that stereotype. This is the challenge, because then you might have one community that says, hey, you're not speaking on our behalf. And then we go, oh, you're right. But then there'll be someone else that says, ah, but proportionally, you are a fraction, you're a minority within a minority, and we don't have the budget to cater for you. But we can't say that because obviously they'd get upset, right? I can get how people would be upset. Just even as a community, this assumption that all minorities are poor, from broken homes, socially deprived, things like that, that's not good. There are assumptions made about people in the workplace where effectively you have no chance of moving onwards and upwards.
So coming back from there, what is the overlap between brand purpose inclusion and brand value or perception?
There is an overlap, or there should be an overlap. Let me put it this way. The reality is that when we look at some of those things, they're not always overlapping. Brands might think that they are, so their purpose and perceptions and value and image and everything, there needs to be sufficient overlap to have that sweet spot where all of those things work together. But some of them might be adrift, and that's why you need to check on those things. I mean, most common example, you know, somebody can think that they're God's gift, right? But if everyone else doesn't, what value does that give to you? And so I would apply the same reasoning to a brand. So it doesn't matter what your mission statement is, what you say in your adverts, if it's not received well by your audience and they don't put their hands in the pocket, then there's a drift and you need to work out where that drift is.
Okay. Your thoughts on categorizations of racial and ethnic groups, BAME, BME, or something else?
They mentioned before, whether that's BAME, Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic, BME, Black, Minority, Ethnic, BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, Person of Color. To be honest, it's a mess. Globalization hasn't made it any easier because now that we're communicating across continents, we're looking for a universally understood term. For example, things also come in and out of fashion. So at the minute, the word black, let's call it fashionable, right, or acceptable. People talk about being a black person and not a colored person. And we could see recently what happened, you know, in the FA when, you know, someone was referred to as being colored and people took offense. But I did look on social media and somebody asked a perfectly legitimate question, which is, why is colored offensive but not person of color? Because in the US, they talk about people of color, and we actually talk about people of color in the UK too. And then I was like, yeah, that's a pretty good point. Or I remember, like, you know, one of my students from South Africa who is mixed race. Mixed race is another term that I hate, but I use, because you kind of have no choice, because even this notion of race, I have problems with, because this idea of mixed race, and there's always that cheesy meme that says there's only one race, which is the human race. It's cheesy, but it's true. Yeah. And so to me, the concept of race means it's almost like you're assuming that we're a different species. That's what racism is. And that leads to problems. And so the whole field is a mess, because the more you look at it, the more you realize that some of these things are kind of contradictory or paradoxical. I'm politically black and I'm quite happy to tick a box saying that I'm a black person. I'm also a mixed race person. But even the term black, I have problems with, because it doesn't link you to a geographic location. So if you're Asian, you're linked to a geographic location and you have heritage and culture and civilization and all of those things. If you're a black person, then you're basically just drifting like any black person. You could be in Africa, it could be in Australia, it could be Aborigine, it could be in Brazil. It's just purely descriptive by the color of your skin. But I kind of feel like we have no choice. So then if we look at whether it's BAME, and people are now getting offended by BAME, but if we look, BAME was supposed to be the solution to BME. Because minority ethnic wasn't enough. And I think that people miss the point, because it's not so much the term, but the fact that the activities linked to that classification that have been going on aren't working well enough. And it becomes easy to blame the term. Yeah. And then that's kind of what companies do. When your business is failing, you think, hey, let's rebrand, and that will yield better results, right? And so basically, you know, you're doing rebranding a time when it's the wrong time to do so, and it's with the wrong intentions. You just think that it's going to solve those problems. And I feel that now with the discussions, and I'm sure that plenty of people disagree with me, I have no issue with BAME. I think that these discussions are basically going to take us down another route where you come up with a new term. God only knows what that will be. And it will wear out, because it won't have achieved what we hope it will, and it will be used in different contexts. So I'm not particularly bothered. Yes, I am offended in the UK if someone calls me coloured. Not so offended that I want them to lose their job. But I do find it offensive, because I think, to me, it's an indicator that you're not up to date with what's going on in this country at the moment. You're out of touch. But if you call me black, okay, maybe I'd be less offended. But then I would be offended if it was used out of context. But then that becomes the tricky thing. There might be some people listening thinking, okay, we can't win, because one minute you want Black Music Awards, Like this week, you might be going for a Black Music Award, but in the same week, you know, PSG and the Turkish football team from Istanbul walked off the field because a football official called, you know, one of the coaching staff black. And they said, why are you referring to the color of my skin? Like, you don't do this to white people. So there are some people that are going to be confused and might think that we're just complaining all the time, whatever. And my advice to you would be, look, you need to kind of walk in our shoes and you need to talk to some more people and get some advice. It's, you know, it's not a different language. And I think it's that awakening, another wave of awakening that we're seeing. And whether that's on one level where Black Panther can smash the records and surprise people because they thought like, wow, we never knew. We knew black people were cool. We didn't know they were that marketable. We didn't know it would work mainstream. I think that this is another interesting age where we're on the curve of hopefully discovering how we can take discussions to the next level. These terms don't really matter to me. They matter to you. I mean, you, the audience, you, the outside world. I made the point at one talk I gave at a conference, I said, I didn't know that I had a black mother and a white father until I went to school. Before that, they were just mum and dad. Like, I don't see them as a black woman and a white man. It's you that does. And now that you do, and you've made it clear to me that that's how you view them and you view me or how we walk down the street when my dad holds my hand, it's now affected our lives. And that's why it's important to me. And so similarly, that when we look at this context, it's like, you know, it's being black is not important to me in that way as much as it's a reflection of how you react towards me. So if I experience racism or discrimination because you see me as being a black person.
My last question, we can see a lot of vocal black women role models all around doing all sorts of fantastic things, setting up networks, talking prominently about it, but very few black men. Why is that?
See, I don't know if that's true because I'd want to see the data, but let's just assume that it is true, right? So if we go on that assumption...
Sorry, I'll just say that just from what I have seen and the networks that I am in, and I could be not looking beyond, so that could be a thing.
Okay, but let's trust your eyes then, and let's say that it is true. I think there's still a real sense of fear of the black man. That trope. And also, you know, it's not just the fear of the black man. I mean, even we could look on social media. There's a disproportionate amount of GIFs that exist where they're depicting this emotional, hysterical black woman. And I have issues with that. But then also you might say, yeah, but I see lots of black people using those GIFs. And I have issues with that too, because I don't think they realize the damage that they do in terms of how people view them. So I think that there are these stereotypical assumptions. Way number one, black women are working really, really, really hard because in a lot of professions, they are paid less than everyone else. So I did see a report that I cited in one of my papers where black and Arab academics are paid less than white academics. And there's a further penalty, tax, whatever you want to call it, if you are female. So it could be that they are working extra hard to try and close that gap. Or you could take an alternative view, which is they are a convenient two-tick box. We get women and black people all at the same time. Bargain, right?
That's a very interesting perspective. And thank you so much, Professor. And I'm sure people will love this conversation and the insights that you've shared with us today. So thank you very much for being here.
Thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.